In cooperation with the Kalamazoo branch, American Association of University Women, station WKZO brings you now the fifth in a series of programs devoted to business problems of the average family and the average individual. Tonight's program, which was recorded earlier, will consist of an interview with Mr. Alfred Connable, Jr., investment counselor, on the subject of investments. Mr. Connable will be interviewed by Mrs. F.C. Birchfield, program chairman of the Kalamazoo branch, AAUW. Mrs. Birchfield.
We now come to the third step in setting up a sound financial program. In the preceding programs, we've stressed the importance of a cash reserve in the bank and a program of insurance benefits. With that accomplished, we need to give some thought to the matter of investing those funds which we have in surplus of our living expenses, our reserves in the savings account, in our insurance. A few years ago, the investor in stocks and bonds was the person with a substantial estate. The purchase of stocks generally were in 100 share lots or more. Today, investment houses tell us that about every 7 out of 10 transactions they have are made up of purchases of small numbers of shares. More and more, the person with a few hundred dollars to invest is investing in stocks and bonds. Perhaps, Mr. Connable, you could give us a brief statement of what constitutes stocks and bonds and their differences.
Surely, Mrs. Birchfield. A stock is a share of ownership in a company. A bond is a loan of money. That is one very fundamental difference that should be clearly understood. A stockholder, as owner, bears all the risk of success or failure of the enterprise. If the company is profitable, so is his investment. If it fails, he may suffer a complete loss. For that reason, the savings he puts into stock is called risk or venture capital. On the other hand, when he buys a bond, he is simply loaning his money at a fixed interest rate for a given number of years. In effect, he is buying a contract, and the return on his investment is never more than the rate specified in the contract. So, while his investment in a bond can never grow, unless it contains special features such as convertibility into stock, it also is less apt to shrink in value. For bondholders or creditors, they are paid first along with the other creditors in case of business failure or liquidation. The stockholders or owners come last.
Well, how would you say that stocks and bonds fit into the financial picture? Why couldn't a young businesswoman, for instance, just go along building up more insurance and more money in her savings account?
Well, of course she could. And during certain periods in our country's economic cycle, she would be better off with just insurance and a savings account if she did that. Take 1929, for example. The crash that year deflated stocks, and many bonds also, to a mere fraction of their cost. At the same time, insurance and savings account money increased in value, assuming they were in financial institutions that remained open because of lower prices for all things bought by the dollar.
Well, that isn't true at the present time, however.
No, in more years than not, we find the economy expanding with rising prices, especially in these post-war years. Stocks provide a means of keeping pace with this growth, of seeing one's dollar return increase in line with the increased cost of living. Bonds do not help in that respect, but they provide a somewhat better return than a savings account. So there's definitely a place for both stocks and bonds in a young woman's financial picture, as well as insurance and a savings account. Such a policy of spreading the investment risk is called diversification, and it is a sound policy.
Well, is there any general rule of thumb in regard to proportions in the different areas of investments? That is, should I have more or less representation in common stock and in insurance, bonds, both government and otherwise, and real estate? If so, what are the proportions which I could use as a guide?
That's a difficult question to answer, Mrs. Birchfield, because circumstances and requirements vary with each individual. In general, I would say, keep enough insurance and savings account cash on hand to cover all reasonable emergencies. Bolster this reserve with enough U.S. savings bonds to give a comfortable feeling should other investments fail. And then the balance I'd put into stocks. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so. But how does a man or a woman go about becoming a successful investor? Is there a definite psychology that an investor should have?
Of course, it takes judgment and experience to become a successful investor. But first of all, one must analyze carefully what he or she expects from an investment. A young person looking to the future might want a growth stock. That is, a growing company paying little in dividends, but plowing back its earnings into business expansion. An older person, perhaps retired, very likely would take a more conservative attitude. A bond with a fixed interest rate or a stock with a very stable dividend record would fit the bill better here. But whatever one buys, and I believe this important to remember, there is no such thing as an investment without risk. That is why thorough investigation and careful selection of stocks and bonds cannot be overemphasized.
Well, if I accumulate a few thousand dollars, how should I go about investing it?
First, I would say you should take your time in finding a reliable advisor. Your banker or family attorney would be a good starting point in this search. Banks with trust department facilities usually provide investment advisors. Then there are the investment dealers and brokers. Their primary business, of course, is the buying and selling of securities, something that must be remembered in seeking their advice, but they do provide free and helpful information. Investment counselors are also available. They should be registered by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it'd be well to inquire of them if they are. To be absolutely unbiased, it is best that these counselors also do not have a broker's license.
Well, you mentioned a moment ago that a potential investor should seek the advice of a reliable investment house or counselor. Well, I'd always had the impression that such services were available only to those persons with large sums to invest. Now, what is the function of an investment counselor?
It is true that the larger nationally known investment counsel firms usually take only accounts of substantial size and charge a management fee based on the size of the portfolio. However, there are plenty of independent counselors or trust company investment advisors that are available to the small investor. Their function is to study their client's security needs from the standpoint of both income and principal requirements, and then investigate and recommend the best stocks and bonds to fit these needs. The recommendations might embrace one or two securities or a whole program or portfolio of securities. They also will supervise the portfolio if desired, which means a constant watch of the companies involved and the ever-changing market conditions of those companies' securities.
Well, the various investment houses in the country offer all sorts of good information in the way of analyses of stock for the small investor, do they not?
Yes, it's really amazing the amount of free information available to investors today. Note I say information and not advice. Free advice is available too, but usually in the form of tips, often of uncertain value. For information, the public library, as is in the case of Kalamazoo Public Library, you'll find that they usually subscribe to the big standard financial services. In the Kalamazoo Library, you can find Moody's, Standard, Poor's and Fitch's publications. You'll also find various financial papers and magazines there. Investment houses subscribe to these services and make them available to their clients. Stock and bond analyses, industry reviews, and economic forecasts are all part of the work of these big financial service organizations. All of this may seem very confusing to any woman inexperienced in financial or investment matters, possibly so, but I still think she should see for herself what a large and complicated business it is to invest one's savings. Then, with the help of her banker or lawyer, she could select an investment advisor with judgment and experience to guide her.
Well, I gather that there are different types of investors, are there not?
Oh, definitely. There are investors who want only situations with a big growth factor. For example, the television stocks. Those stocks a year ago were interesting to buyers who were looking for big growth. They were willing to wait for dividends, figuring that in the long run, their investment would be more profitable because the industry was young and dynamic. Another type of investor is the one primarily interested in a steady and regular return from his money. Still another is concerned, first of all, with the safety of his invested principal. While nothing can be taken for granted in the securities market, still many stocks or bonds are safer than others, and for the safety factor, usually pay a higher price.
Well, you've mentioned several different types of investors. Now, the classification, I understand, is based upon the investor's objectives. Also, there are three factors involved: growth, income, and safety. Now, at what period in an investment program should a person be interested in the growth factor in investments? Is there any time I can be more interested in growth than in the safety of my investment?
Yes, younger people generally, or older people with assured income from other sources, can best afford the so-called growth stocks. Later on in life, we naturally become more conservative, and we should be. For at that time, we are often retired from our business or professional lives. Our invested savings, then, are our financial security that stands between us and the poorhouse.
Well, you can't have all three at the same time in an investment, can you?
No, unfortunately you can't. Big growth possibilities, high income, and at the same time safety of principal don't exist in any one security. A growing concern is busy reinvesting earnings rather than paying big dividends. The safest bonds in the world are our U.S. government obligations with a top interest rate yield of 2.90% and no growth factor. No, all three objectives simply cannot be achieved in any one security. Within a portfolio, yes, by selecting a well-balanced list of different types of securities, but within one stock or bond, no.
Well, we've talked about the investor who must have her income from investments to live, and the investor who's trudging along the road to financial security. But now what about the person solely interested in speculation or capital gain?
Speculation is something else again. It is human nature and good business too to buy cheap and sell dear. I am not criticizing the speculator in securities at all when I say he is not an investor in any sense of the word. He faces the possibility of loss, which might prove disastrous. The investor, especially in growth stocks, may realize a profit or a capital gain in the long run, too. But he does not buy today to sell tomorrow. He buys to be a part owner of a company whose future he likes, and he is thinking in terms of years, not days.
Well, Mr. Conable, is there any protection for the investor against fraudulent schemes?
Yes, there is some protection by way of state regulation. All states today have special laws, usually called blue sky laws, aimed at protecting the purchaser of stocks and bonds from fraud. These laws are extremely complex, but they do prevent the sale of most gold brick or wholly fraudulent investments. In Michigan, the commission charged with the execution of the blue sky law has the power to limit the price at which securities can be sold in the state, as well as the power to prohibit the sale of securities where the sale would work fraud or deception or be on unfair terms.
Well, aren't there federal regulations governing those situations, too?
Yes, that's right, too. In 1934, the Securities Exchange Act was passed by Congress. That's the act that's often referred to as the Truth Act, since its basic plan is to bring forth a complete and accurate disclosure of all pertinent facts regarding the company issuing the securities and the nature of the securities. Just as in the case of the operation of the state blue sky laws, the SEC, as it's called, does not guarantee the investment quality of the securities. The Federal Act merely makes all the facts regarding these security issues available to the purchaser. Then it becomes a let the buyer beware proposition. Besides giving a margin of protection to investors, these state laws and the federal law have had a most wholesome effect upon the securities business. It has raised the standards of both the companies issuing securities and the dealers in securities.
Well, thank you, Mr. Conable, for discussing with us some of the basic principles upon which an investment program may be based. In the next broadcast, I'd like to raise some questions concerning the purchase of different types of stocks, such as common and preferred stocks, and investment trust funds for the investor with a small amount to invest.
You've been listening to a recorded interview with Mr. Alfred Conable, Jr., investment counselor, conducted by Mrs. F.C. Birchfield. This was the fifth in a series of programs devoted to the business problems of the average family and average individual. Mr. Conable and Mrs. Birchfield will be with us again next Wednesday evening at the same time to continue their discussion of investments. This has been another program presented in the public interest by the Fetzer Broadcasting Company.